Good morning and welcome back to the second hour. Focus 580, this is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Producing the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and at the controls this morning, Henry Frayn. In this part of the program, we'll be talking about this summer's offering, operatic offering, as part of the Sugar Creek Symphony and Song. It's an opera and classical music festival in Watseka, Illinois. It is in its third year now and seems steadily to be getting more attention and drawing bigger audiences. This year, they are presenting Rossini's opera Cinderella, and we're pleased here to have with us in the studio three people who are important parts of this festival. John Whitman, he is one of the founders and also is the president and executive director. Christine McIntyre, she's a member of the stage directing staff at the Metropolitan Opera in New York, and she is the stage director for the production. And also Sean Sims, he's a cast member, he's a baritone and singing on the production. And we'll talk a little bit about Rossini and his music and this opera and how it is it ended up in Watseka and some of the challenges in staging this production here. And people who are listening are certainly welcome to call as well with questions. And I know our guest will do their best to give you an answer. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to call in, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere, that you can hear us. 800-222-9455. So at any point here, if you have questions, you can call us. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. One of the things I thought I would do first is to talk a little bit about John, with John, about having started this festival in the first place, because I know a lot of people have the same reaction. They hear opera and Watseka, and they say opera? In Watseka? Now, Watseka is a lovely community. Folks of Watseka, please do not start writing letters. It's not intended as a commentary on Watseka, but it's not the kind of place that you expect to find opera. How is it that this is taking place in Watseka?
Well, Sugar Creek Symphony and Song started about 3 years ago. Helen Todd, who's the artistic director, and myself decided that we wanted to give something back to the place where we grew up. And why Watseka is really a common question that I get. I'll go somewhere and they'll say, well, why Watseka? You know, mm-hmm. Or why not here where I am? Or why not in this other place? And so why Watseka is really a common question for me. And the simple answer is we grew up in Watseka and we're from Watseka. And we wanted to give something back to the place where we grew up. Helen Todd is a lyric coloratura soprano. She sings across the U.S. and beyond and has a great career. And when we were discussing, well, what could we do for her, she had gone to several music festivals and summer music festivals across the U.S. And had like OK Mozart or Central City Opera and had said, this would be really great if we could do something like this in the town where we grew up and create a music festival like this. So that was the impetus for the idea. And so we just tried to build it from there and create something that would draw people to the community, create great musical events for rural Americans who don't necessarily have great access to the arts or feel uncomfortable driving to Chicago or Indianapolis to experience the arts, and just create an altogether great weekend and a great series of activities.
Yeah. Do many people who are involved in the production have some kind of central Illinois connection?
No. No. Well, the orchestra mostly comes from here in Illinois. However, the singers are brought in literally from all over the U.S. and beyond.
Yeah.
For example, Sean Sims, who's here today, came from New Orleans. Another singer came from New York City, another from San Jose, California, another from Toronto, Canada. Christine, the director, is here from she works at the Met and lives in Seattle, is that correct?
Portland, Oregon.
Portland, Oregon. Mm. And, you know, so we bring in what Helen tries to do as artistic director is bring in the most talented, experienced people she can find to come to Watseka and put this on and create as high level of a production as possible for both the people who live there and the people who travel in to see it.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about Rossini.
Okay.
As a composer. Certainly in his time, he was extremely popular and extremely successful, was a composer of what is known as both comic and serious operas. Mm-hmm. Maybe he would have thought he would have liked to have been known more for his serious operas than his comic ones, but probably in the minds of audiences, what they know best are the comic operas, and probably the number one would be The Barber of Seville.
Absolutely.
And maybe Cinderella might come number two. What do you think is special about Rossini that had made him so popular in his day and still so popular?
I think the music is incredibly accessible, and it's very witty music as well. He knows how to write comic music for the stage. The music is inherently funny, and he knows how to shape a scene so that it takes you from A to B to C and finally builds to this wonderful comic finale. And he does it at the end of every act and does it consistently in each of his pieces over and over and over again. And we never get tired of that pattern. He's simply good at it.
I'll turn to the singer here and ask the question. What makes this singing funny? What makes it comic? What separates that from a dramatic kind of singer?
Well, for the singers, at least, what we hear in the music has a great deal to do with, the sort of images that are conjured up by the type of music. If you listen to sort of traditional classical music, there's a dramatic quality to it. For Rossini, there's a lot of little, almost like effects that he creates when he writes that are very specifically meant to coincide with some business on the stage. And so he's really, really great at personifying certain aspects of the character or the situation that dramatically needs to happen in his music. And it's very identifiable. It's almost, if you're staging the opera, if you don't address those parts of the music, they almost seem out of place.
Absolutely. He gives you this roadmap, and you kind of have to follow it. Doesn't mean you have to do the same thing that everyone else has done, but you sort of ignore those moments at your peril because he's built it up musically to the point where the audience clearly expects something to happen there. So we have to find answers for that.
I think probably people have seen operas where what characters do is they come out on the stage and they stand there and they sing.
Yeah. Not in my opera.
Well, maybe not in your opera, but there certainly there is... it's not simply singing. There is a very large component of acting. And I imagine probably from one production to the next and from one performer to the next, that may change depending upon what the people who mount the production think are important and the skills of the performers. How do you think about that, and how do you integrate acting? And indeed, how much of that is something that you develop, and how much of that comes that grows out of the music and something that the composer has actually told you, this is what I want people to be doing at any particular time?
Well, the first thing you have to do as an opera director is start with the score. The music is not something that you try to fight. The music is there as your guide, and it's the story you're trying to tell. Once you understand what story the music is trying to tell, then you can make some good decisions about how you want to personify the characters. And Cenerentola, Cinderella, is an opera about character. It's about very specific kinds of characters who are thrown into situations in which they're made to feel very uncomfortable. They're kind of fish out of water the whole show. So then with the singers, you try to figure out what they're good at, what they can bring to it naturally, and how we're going to create those characters to suit their voice, given the style of Rossini's music.
It's a really good question because considering that this particular music is very difficult to sing, the bel canto style and the level of concentration you need, one would sort of naturally tend to want to stand still. And not, besides the regular singer mentality of just wanting to stand still in any way, in this show you can't, because it doesn't really carry the story if you don't really get into the characters and move them around. But this is where Christine's brilliant in this, and she allows us to move when we can and kind of hold still when we need to. There are some real points where you just can't do anything else but kind of concentrate on what you're doing if you want to do it justice. And she allows us to move when it's most natural for us and still tell the story, but also to kind of find our place to hold still and, be involved with the music technically too.
Because the music has moments of stillness as well, and it's important, I think, in any comic show that has lots of sort of running around in comic business to find those sort of wonderful moments of stillness to give the audience a breather and give the singers a breather as well. But this is music that makes you want to move. When I sit and listen to it in my living room, I can't imagine people standing still, for several hours singing this sort of thing, because it just makes you want to get up and move around. And so I think as audience, we expect to see that music realized in a physical way.
Mm. Rossini as a musician was, as I read about his life, very well-rounded. He was a great composer. He was also a performer, and was also apparently quite a good singer himself.
Yeah, he studied voice, he studied composition, but he played the horn, he played the cello, he played the harpsichord and the piano. He had musical parents. His mother was a singer. His father was a horn player. So he grew up in a family where all of these things were around him all the time. He took advantage of those opportunities. And by the age of about 14, had kind of mastered composition and began, you know, turning his hand to actually writing opera.
As a singer, when you sing his music or you look at the music, does the fact that he apparently was a singer and not a bad singer come through? Do you look at it and say, well, clearly this is someone who wrote this was a singer?
I do see that. I mean, having the luxury of having some music where it was clearly obvious that the composer wasn't totally familiar with the voice. Singing Rossini is challenging and it's difficult, but it's doable. And it's meant to be, you know, it's meant to push a really talented singer to his limits. But it's still, you know, something that's not going to make the audience uncomfortable because it's just so out there. The ranges are all very appropriate for the voice types. And, you know, the level of singing is very challenging and beautiful, but, you know, still within the boundaries of what we're capable of doing.
Earlier you used the term bel canto. This is a bel canto opera.
Right.
What does that mean?
Bel canto refers to a period of music. I mean, there's classical, pre-classical, Baroque, and bel canto traditionally has to do more specifically with probably three composers, Bellini, Rossini, and Donizetti. And for bel canto, quite literally meaning beautiful singing, for us has to do with the florid nature of the music. There's a lot of coloratura runs in it, which you won't hear in a lot of different styles, as well as what we call really long lines of singing, long phrases that require a tremendous amount of breath control, and which is what we really try to focus on. And it's kind of, for singers, the gold standard by which we set high singing at. The bel canto is really the ultimate in as far as difficulty, beauty, technical ability. It's a real, real difficult style.
Vocal acrobatics.
What, John, who did you choose this particular opera?
No, Helen, working with our artistic director, working with the conductor. They hashed it out last year. Our first 2 years, we did La Boheme and then Romeo and Juliet. So we did two tragedies on the prairie in Watsika and amongst the cornfields. And we said, okay, that's enough. We need a comedy. We need to do something to make people laugh. And we were getting that feedback from people as well back in town. They were saying, you know, we'd really like to see a comedy and experience that. So we thought we'd treat them this year. And Helen and our conductor, Anthony Walker, came up with a really great choice.
Was it important, do you think, that it'd be a work that people would be relatively familiar with, or a composer that people would relatively be familiar with?
Well, we query people after each festival, and I, as executive director and kind of the guy who has to make the business part of it work, I divide people up into groups. So we have one group that is people in Watsika and Iroquois County, and what are they looking for? And they're typically people who may not have experienced much opera in the past, may travel occasionally for classical music or opera, but really not much at all. I mean, for a large portion of our audience, we have literally hundreds and if not more than 1,000 people who come out who really have never experienced an opera before coming to our performances. So we want to cater to that audience. And so when we choose an opera, we say, okay, what will be something that would be you know, not too abstract, but accessible to an audience that's new to opera, and keep them excited and grow them as a new base for opera. And then we also look at the group and say, well, we want people to travel in. We want to be able to attract opera lovers from beyond. I mean, for example, we had two people come last year from Japan and Singapore, and they wanted to know what was going on in Watsika. They wanted to, and they were willing to travel that distance because they wanted to see our production, and they tied it into other activities in the area. This year we have someone coming from Mexico as well. And so we want to be that that strong, that we are able, with the type of productions we put on, to be able to draw people from who love opera and are willing to travel for it. And so we look at those are two very important groups for us. So when Helen and we all sit down to discuss the opera we'll do next year, then we say, how do we cater to those groups, and will we continue to attract attention both in the area and well beyond the area as well?
Yeah. Mounting an opera is no small thing. You have to have an orchestra. You have to have a lot of performers. You have to have scenery and costumes and all of that. And in addition, you have to have a suitable venue. What does it cost to do this?
Our budget typically runs between upwards of $200,000 a year. And quite frankly, that's no small feat for a small town of 5,700 people.
And how did you go about raising this money?
I ask for money every day. I wake up in the morning thinking about money. I go to bed at night thinking about money. And quite frankly, I think I have the worst job in the whole production. I wish I could be a singer.
We thank you for it.
Yes.
Well, and, without you, there would be no production.
It's really amazing to see how people have responded. Most of our money comes locally from, you know, within about a 15-mile radius of Watseka. And so we're really grateful that that people in the small community are willing to believe in us and, you know, open their hearts and their wallets and say, hey, this is a crazy idea, but let's try it. And we'll go see it, and we'll give you some money to do it. And I've never seen an opera, but I think this is a really great thing. You know, we had an event a couple weeks ago for donors, and it was a really great event, and, you know, just to give back to them, where all the singers came together and sang a selection for them. And they'll come up to me, and they'll say, you know, I'd never thought I would have enjoyed something like this, but I really do. And
well, it was a big help, too, to bring in the level of talent that's here, all the way from the conductors down to the singers. You would not suspect this quality of production in Watseka. They really just went over the top with this, and not just the production, but the festival itself. I think you can expect this level every year. Mm-hmm. And if you've ever been to Watseka, or when you first get there, it really is shocking to see how major a production this is, considering on the surface of what it looks like it may be.
And when we look down the road, let's say 10 or 15 years, we say, well, what do we want to become? And I mean, quite frankly, we didn't do this just to be one weekend a year and one opera a year. I mean, we want to become a Glimmer Glass, or we want to become a Wolf Trap opera. We want to become something that would be a nationwide festival that would leave a mark on the summer opera and classical music scene. And so we have very high aspirations, and that's why we try to do the very best we can each year.
Let me reintroduce the guest for anybody who has just tuned in. We're talking with some of the people who are responsible for the Sugar Creek Symphony and Song. It's an opera and classical music festival taking place in Watseka, Illinois. And the performances are this coming weekend. And as part of the festival, they're mounting a production of Rossini's comic opera Cinderella. And our three guests are John Whitman. He is one of the founders of the festival. He is also the president and executive director. Christine McIntyre, she is the stage director. And Sean Sims is one of the performers. We have a recording of Cinderella, and we thought we would play a little bit of music for folks. We're going to feature here something from Dandini. Now, this is the character that Sean Sims plays.
Right.
It's not him singing. I'm not sure who this is, but it's not him. We do have a recording of Sean that perhaps will play as well, something from Barber of Seville.
Right.
But just to give people a little bit of a taste of the music, why don't we do this? Do you know what this is?
Yeah, I think this is probably Dandini's aria called Come Ape, that is really a great example of bel canto, which we talked about earlier. The first part of the aria is the long lines that we talked about, and then a little later on you get a lot of the coloratura, which are the really fast singing with a lot of the different notes that shows how difficult it is. And so it's not a bad example.
Okay. Well, let's hear that.
Thank you.
All right, that is Alessandro Corbelli in the role of Dandini, the servant to the prince. And people know, obviously, they know the story of Cinderella. But maybe we should explain what Rossini does with this story. This is a particularly comic character
right.
that is introduced to generate some...
Right. In this version, Dandini's character is the prince's valet, or his, you know, to update, it would be more like his personal assistant. His valet dresses him and gets him ready to go everywhere. And in this particular version, Dandini... and the prince is looking for a mate or a bride, sends out Dandini disguised as the prince in order to facilitate finding true love and not someone looking to marry up, as it were. So he sends Dandini out so that he can take Dandini's place as a valet, and they can both go out, and the prince can sort of secretly look for who he would really like, while the Dandini can serve as a distraction.
So a frequent identity switching is one of these things,
right.
The frequent themes we see in a lot of productions.
Actually, yeah. Almost everyone is in disguise at some point in the opera.
All right. Very good. We have a caller here to talk with. Why don't we do that? Bring them into the conversation here on our line number one in Urbana. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I heard earlier that David asked about people locally who might be involved in the production, and I just wanted to add in there that Lee Boyer, who's a former Cranert person and has a studio here in town, is the scene designer and scenic artist on the production, and that I think some of the props also came from Cranert. So there is some local involvement that I know about, at least.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's true. And Lee Boyer and Rebecca Switzer, who used to be associated with the University of Illinois, are aiding in this production. Barbara Hedlund, who's a resident here in Champaign and whose husband is the head of the voice department at the University of Illinois, she's in our orchestra. And there's several orchestra members who come here from the Champaign area, Bloomington, Peoria, and then up into Chicago as well. So there's a lot of great local involvement as well.
Okay, very good. Well, right. Thanks. Other questions, comments, whatever are certainly welcome. You want to give us a call, you can be involved in the show. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I want to particularly ask Christine, what sort of challenges are presented in staging this in the physical setting that you have to do it in?
Well, one of the decisions that was made before I became involved in the production was that we wanted to use the same basic setup that they had last year, which involves, instead of having an orchestra pit, kind of having an orchestra pool with the stage behind it, to the sides of it, and in front of it. So depending on where the singers are, they could be to the side of the conductor or even downstage of the conductor. So instead of having one large staging space, I have several different kinds of staging spaces and then a sort of 25-foot pool in the middle of it. So just using that physical space has been a great challenge, but something that we, I think, have turned into a real benefit for our production, because it gives me a way of separating people and doing some very interesting, very challenging kind of staging ideas.
Well, and Christine even has, the characters interact with the orchestra, since it's such a unique orchestra pit that we have.
We actually talked to the conductor at various points, and at one point they decide to get mad at the conductor in one of the big Rossini ensembles about the fact that it's too hard to sing, and they all yell at him, and he actually has to sort of sink down into the orchestra pit to avoid getting beat up by the singers.
Oh, and you would never want to beat up a conductor, would you?
Well, I'm not getting into that on the air.
Well, you do take his baton, though.
Yeah, we do. At one point, he actually offers his baton so that I can abuse another colleague, but that's just another one of our ways of interacting with the orchestra.
Very good.
We had a dress rehearsal last night, and I thought that people responded very well to the interaction really enjoyed it. Yeah,
I think the conductor quite enjoys it, too. I've never met one yet that didn't enjoy, you know, a greater opportunity to be involved in the production. So
very good. We have some other folks to talk with. Let's do that. Next caller is in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I was wondering, for people who are new to opera, haven't had much experience with it, would your guests have a suggestion of something one could read before going to such a production? And I can hang up and listen. Thank you.
All right.
Certainly one can get on the web various synopses, stories of the opera. You can actually read libretti. If you can get a recording, usually there's a libretto that has both the Italian and the English. At the production itself, we use supertitles. English text translations are projected on the side. So this is actually a great piece to come to if you're new to opera. The music's really accessible. It's a funny piece. It's a story we all know. And we put the English up there, right there for you to see. So there's no problem about not understanding what's going on.
Right. Picking up a recording is a great idea because you get to familiarize yourself with the music. And almost in all of the recent recordings, they have libretto, which is the actual word-for-word translation of what everyone is saying, usually in different languages too, from English, German, French, Italian, all in the same book. And it also has the story of the plot, story, a little bit blurb about the composer. They're a really great resource for people who want to check it out.
And I found that the last 3 years for the way Helen and the director and have staged our productions, that they're very theatrical in nature, and that people generally have not had problems following along or getting lost. Someone brought up earlier the idea of just standing and singing, and that's definitely not a model that we follow. And I really like that how theatrical everything is, because it does convey the message of what's going on without having to rely even as much as you might think on the supertitles.
Well, it's something interesting, and I definitely wanted to talk about it, because I know in a lot of places this is somewhat controversial, and different companies are wrestling with how to do this.
It certainly can be a huge issue.
Dealing with the language barrier, the fact that operas are sung in French and in German and in Italian, and you want to involve the audience, and the question is, you know, how do you deal with that? And there are different places they're doing it in different ways, and there are some people who think that's a distraction for the audience. Actually, that you want them to be paying attention to the production, and if they're trying to watch that and also read lyrics that are someplace on the back of their seat or over the proscenium or whatever it is, that gets in the way.
Well, I mean, I understand that it's a little bit distracting, but I think it's a better option than some of the other choices. I mean, the choices would be to not do anything at all and to therefore strand an audience that generally isn't going to speak French or Italian or German, as most of us don't, to translate them into English, which in good English translation is fine. And that's what the composers would have done in their lifetime. Rossini certainly prepared French versions of his operas to be done, you know, in Paris during his lifetime. But there aren't so many resources to do that kind of thing, and it has to be done very carefully. English is also a very difficult language in which to sing this style of music. It's particularly suited to Italian. So for this particular piece, supertitles is actually the best choice. Hopefully in the staging, we've also organized the story and done it in a way that if people don't want to read the supertitles, they certainly don't have to understand what's going on.
Yeah, and this particular production is really quite ingenious. The supertitles are a little to the either side of the stage. This is a very wide set. And so they're almost out of your peripheral vision if you're watching the show, so that they're not distracting when they're changing. And also, Christine's brilliant staging allows you to, with the combination of most people knowing the basic story of Cinderella, to just simply watch what's going on, and the physical interactions tell the story enough, and it's really terrific.
Let's talk with someone in Urbana, line three. Hello.
Hello.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up in Watsika, so it's been very exciting for me to have this happen in my little hometown. I think we're very grateful for all that John and Helen have done. And I did go to the production last year and had no idea what it would feel like to watch an opera in my grade school gymnasium. But there is not a bad seat in the house, and the orchestra pool works extremely well. I think the subtitles are just, they're essential for that audience. They're essential for me, and they're completely not distracting. So I just think it's an excellent, wonderful thing that you're doing. Thank you so much.
All right. Well,
thanks
for the call. And I think that I'm sure that the caller speaks for a lot of people. We were talking a little earlier that in some places there's a lot of controversy about providing the essentially subtitles, supertitles, whatever, providing a translation and as people going along. But I'm sure that there are also a lot of audience members who are very pleased about that. It allows
Absolutely.
Them better to follow what's going on.
Everyone I've spoken with has said, you know, how will I understand the story? And when I explain about the supertitles, they're so excited to find out that there won't be that language barrier, because it shouldn't be a barrier. There's no reason that opera can't become the populist art form it started out to be. So this is one way of making it so that everyone and anyone can come to the opera and enjoy it and understand what's happening.
Yeah.
And actually, the last time I saw an English language opera, which was a wedding at Chicago Lyric in January, it was in English and they projected English subtitles.
Which is actually, if you think, even more controversial than doing it for a foreign language piece.
Well, I certainly know that one of the things that's a part of singers' training is elocution. Just because you're singing in English, that doesn't mean that people listening to you are going to be able to completely hear what it is that you're saying. It's not an easy thing to do, to sing and to make the words clear so that it's still beautiful singing, but also it's something that people can obviously understand.
Right. The supertitles, I think, really were intended not as a following along word for word the entire story, but more as a reference. If there was some part of the story you didn't understand or maybe a particular joke that was trying to be communicated, it was a way to sort of check in and say, oh, that's what they're talking about. And then you went back to watching the story just like you would a regular play or musical.
Just during the time that we were playing the selection that we did, John suggested that we could give away some tickets. Now, I'm not sure how we're going to do this. I don't want to lay some real complicated thing suddenly on Henry, my director's looking at me like, what? What are you expecting me to do? What do you think we could do to give away some tickets here?
Well,
I think we suggested maybe a really kind of simple trivia question that we could ask and see. I think anyone who follows the opera at all will probably know this, but for the general public, this might be an interesting trivia fact that they would find curious, but would also a way for us to actually give away a pair of tickets.
All right. Well, we can do that, and then if people want to try to answer the question, they'll have to call in.
Right.
We can get their answer, and the first person who is in with the correct answer, then
I'll take care of them after that.
All right. We'll get their name and address and phone
exactly.
number and all the information, and we'll make sure they have some tickets. All right.
And this would be for the Sunday performance of Cenerentola on August 7th at 2 p.m. in Watsika.
All right. So what is the question?
The question is, in Rossini's version of Cinderella, there is no glass slipper. He uses a different device. What device does he use?
If you know the answer, call us. 333-9455 or toll free 800-222-9455, and we'll require you to give the answer on the air, and the first person who is in with the correct answer then we have some tickets for Sunday's performance of Cinderella in Watsika, and that is this coming Sunday.
Yes.
Make sure people understand. Okay, that's the deal. Otherwise, if you have questions or comments, or you just want to call in and talk with our guests, you may do that as well. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Well, now that I know this is being performed in a high school gym, see, I'm even more interested in talking with Christine about the challenges and the difficulties of the physical setting.
Well, there is the set that we've talked about that has this orchestra pool. It looks like a real opera set. I mean, the high walls, and there's a balcony, and there's a wonderful kind of colonnade with arches and a platform and all of that sort of thing. And we've brought in a truss, some scaffolding to hold the lights, and so we have, you know, real theatrical lighting equipment. One of the big things is that the singers are much closer to the audience. Because there's no pit separating them, suddenly the singers are right there. That's actually a little challenging for the singers. They're used to having a little distance, and I think it's a little freaky for them to suddenly make eye contact with people because
mm-hmm.
they're not really used to doing that. But it's a wonderful thing for the audience. I've also taken advantage of the fact that we're in that situation, and I've staged some entrances actually through the audience. When Cinderella comes to the ball, everyone looks out to the audience, and she actually suddenly appears from within the audience and comes up to the stage, because it seemed like a fun opportunity to actually include the audience at certain points and take advantage of the fact that we have this unusual situation.
It's almost worth the trip just to come and see the transformation of this place. This the particular venue is not unlike any high school auditorium gymnasium combination setting. But to walk into that theater that's been completely transformed, it's almost worth the trip itself just to see how someone did that. And it was impressive to all the singers.
Well, and perhaps I should apologize for not having said very much about you specifically and your career and where you perform, but I certainly know that you have performed a lot of places around the world in Houston, in Seattle, in New York City, in Lisbon, in Rome, other places. In what way is this different, and perhaps indeed one of the important ways is how close you are to the audience?
Right. Well, we did talk about this actually on the trip over here. The difference for singers is usually there is a tremendous amount of difference, and it's usually very dark with the combination of the lights being on us and the audience sitting in the dark. I almost never see another human face that I'm relating to. So to come out there and be within feet of the public, I think is good on both sides, because we have a real connection to the audience that we don't normally have, as well as the audience being so close to that particular kind of skill and talent is something that you don't get often. And I think that's fascinating to a lot of people, to be that close and to be able to see the inner workings of some things and how that, and just really how difficult it is to do this.
Mm-hmm. I forget, because I sit, 10, 12 feet away from these people in rehearsal, and I have this kind of unique perspective that most of the audience doesn't get. That in a normal opera house, you don't have that kind of intimate relation where you can actually see their facial expressions without, using opera glasses or something.
Yeah.
So it's wonderful in a way. It's letting the audience in on what it feels like to be in rehearsal with these people.
That's interesting. I guess it makes me also think about the difference when you're watching dance, what it's like if you're way, way back in some sort of very large theater, or if you're in some kind of small environment where dancers are very close. One of the things that you're really struck by is you realize this is hard work.
Yes.
It is very physically demanding. And I think people, it's something they don't appreciate about singing. You can, and it's one of the reasons that you can tell the difference between someone who's singing and someone who's lip syncing.
Oh, yeah. There's a big difference. Not only lip syncing, but, the idea of amplified sound. We don't use any amplified sound in these performances. So the singers, what you hear is not any kind of reproduction of them. It's them right from their mouth to your ears. And the closer you are to something like that, the more impressive it really is, because it's just the generation difference between this kind of entertainment and when people used to listen to this all the time to what we're used to listening to in popular music now is so different that alone it can carry an evening. Just the jaw-dropping sort of unusualness of it. Is enough to hold people's attention for a long time, and it's really, really impressive.
Well, this, and maybe I would ask John to talk about this again. I think it goes back to this idea that you're maybe introducing audiences to a kind of performance they haven't just simply not experienced before, and that they may come there with particular kinds of ideas about what it's going to be like, and find that, in fact, that it's really very different.
Yeah, we usually get feedback saying that they're very surprised. They had no idea they would enjoy it so much, and that always pleases us. And in terms of the gym, our goal has always been I always call it the auditorium instead of the gym. It's the Glenn Raymond Auditorium. And our goal is that when the lights go down, you forget where you're at. And I think that thanks to Christine and all the singers and the orchestra and Anthony and everybody involved with this, that really does happen. It just all melts away.
We have about 15 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Maybe I should introduce again our guests. We're talking with John Whitman. He is one of the founders and also is the president and executive director of the Sugar Creek Symphony and Song in Watseka, Illinois. This weekend, the performances, and they'll be giving performance of Rossini's opera Cinderella. Christine McIntyre is here. She is a member of the stage directing staff at the Metropolitan Opera in New York. Recently, they directed the Barber of Seville. And she is the stage director for the performance of Cinderella. And also with us is Sean Sims. He's a baritone, a cast member, sings the role of Dundini in the opera. And questions, welcome, certainly, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I tell you what, one of the things that we had is a recording of Sean singing. And I know, Henry, do you have that CD we burned, that ready to go? This is not Cinderella. This is Barber of Seville. But I'd like to give people an opportunity to hear your voice, your singing voice, as right. well as hearing you here talk with
us. Well, it's a good idea, too, because it gives you an example of the different style of music, even though it's within the same bel canto style. This is a little different type of music that you would hear at the performance. It's a nice combination of getting to hear the Cenerentola and then a little bit of Barber, too.
All right. Well, let's hear that.
Largo la tomba della città, largo. La 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 la. Presto botteghi calabaccia, presto. La 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 la. Oh, che bel vivere, che bel piacere, che bel piacere. Per un barbiere di qualità, oh, bravo Figaro, bravo, bravo, bravissimo, bravo. La 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 la. Porto d'altissimo per vanità, bravo. La 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 la. Fortunatissimo per verità, fortunatissimo per verità, la 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 la.
Sean Sims, that's Figaro.
Right.
Right? From Barber of Seville.
Mm-hmm.
That certainly should be recognizable to a lot of
right,
folks, whether they know about opera or not.
Exactly. I think that's why Figaro probably is one of the more popular operas, is because of the musical references. There's obviously the Bugs Bunny cartoons and things like this. So many people are very familiar with that music, whereas Cinderella, they're more familiar with the story. And that's enough reason to come and see it. It's a really great love story, and the actors are all terrific in it.
What got you interested in singing, in this kind of singing?
Well, let's see. I grew up in Texas, and there in their public school systems, interscholastically, two very big components are sports and music. And so I was involved in both. I ended up being a better singer than I was a football player. So I really never chose to be a singer. I received a scholarship to go to school for it, and I thought, okay, well, I'll use this opportunity to at least get an education, and then I kept receiving scholarships to higher education, and then just I never could say no.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure that it's just part of the nature of the life of a singer, that it's kind of peripatetic existence, that to be able to have steady work, you can't stay in one place.
No.
You've got to travel. And
yeah,
as I mentioned earlier, you've performed in Europe, you've performed all over the United States. Is that difficult to have that just be a reality of your life?
It is. I don't know anyone who really deals with it very well. There are problems, issues with your family life. If you choose to have one, you're never home. I mean, last year I was home maybe 4 weeks out of the whole year, and those weren't 4 consecutive weeks. And so now recently my wife and I are expecting our first child, and I'm stopping for a while just so I can be home and I don't miss any of that. But you can't have it both. I think Thomas Allen is a really well-known singer at the Met, and he mentioned to me one time, he said, look, nobody has it all. You choose, and if you're lucky enough to have those choices, you deal with what you choose, and you have to kind of make choices.
Is that true also for you?
Absolutely. Okay. I mean,
Christine?
There's not enough directing work in any one town, and I choose to live in Portland, Oregon, because it's a wonderful place to live, and my husband and I enjoy it very much. I work at the Metropolitan Opera, so it's quite a commute, which means I spend 4 or 5 months a year in New York, and then I freelance elsewhere, come to places like this to do my thing. So,
well, when you do what you do, by the time that the curtain goes up on opening night, you're done. Or
hopefully,
are you done?
Hopefully I'm done.
So how much time does it take to do all of this preparation phase, the part that you're involved in, right up to the point where we say, okay, take it away and break a leg?
I started working on this last November or December when Helen called me and asked me to start coming up with a plan for how I might do it. And honestly, that's a little later in the process than usually I would start. I work on things for 6 months to a year in advance, because I have to come, in a 3-week rehearsal period, there's not a lot of time to futz around. Mm-hmm. So you come with all your ducks in a row, knowing what you want to do, certainly having, done all of the designs for the set, the costumes, the props, and having had, very intense discussions with the lighting designer about what is and isn't possible and what tack you're going to take.
It seems to me that 3 weeks is not a very long time
no.
to get something together that's this complicated and involves this many people. There's a good-sized cast. There is the orchestra. There's all of the stuff that's really got to come together. Three weeks is not very much
time. It's a marathon.
It is a marathon, but I mean, one of the things that makes it different, say, from doing a stage play is that the singers all come with their parts absolutely learned. We may make choices within that about ways of approaching things or how loud or softly to sing something or what kind of ornaments to do. But basically that part is done. So we start a little further into the process than you might
and
for something
as
else.
As the singers, they, I mean, to John's testament too, he brought in really top-rate talent. And so a lot of the people have done these roles before. This is what we consider our standard repertoire. Mm-hmm. So many people know the show like the back of their hand. And so it is very easy to kind of bring a group of people who are that on top of it and say, look, you just go there, you go there, you do your thing, and then we'll tighten things up here and there. And so 3 weeks is not unreasonable. Yeah. I mean, it really came together.
Well, so as you say, and I'm sure that it is true that there are particular singers that specialize in particular kind of music. There are people who sing Wagner, and that's what they
You're
do.
Right. And absolutely, that's an interesting point, because for the longest time, and even you know before the past 50 years, singers had a very specific repertoire they sang, and that was it. And you had specialists. So, but now, in particular for American singers, we're required to be able to perform a wider repertoire. And so it puts a great deal more pressure on us to be at that level as those specialists at any given time. You know, we may go from, you know, Rossini to Wagner to Puccini all within a couple of months. And honestly, there's the technical issue of it, which is, you know, just singing the music, but also physicality of it, just being able to physically change directions like that. Some of the music is a lot harder on your breath. Some of it is a lot harder on your resonating and, you know, things like that. To make those gear shifts is really, really difficult. Mm.
Well, even if you have a particular role that you have sung a number of times, how many times have you sung Figaro?
Figaro, I've sung over 100 times. Yeah. I've done 122 performances of that.
So you have an idea about how it is you sing it and how it is you approach it. If you're working with different conductors, different music directors, different stage directors, and do they have very different ideas, and do you have to you have one sort of idea that's okay, this is the way that I do it, with somebody else saying no. This is the way that we're going to do it, and so then you have to adjust to what it is they want.
That is absolutely the case every single time. I've never showed up and it's been just what I would want to do. It's always artistic differences. I mean, we all have different backgrounds, different people we admire, different influences. No one has the same vision 100% that you have. But when you go into a production, the conductor handles the music, director handles the staging, and I draw the line at that, and I do whatever they tell me.
Hmm. I'm sure you worked with some difficult performers, have you?
Absolutely, although it's interesting how you get sort of higher up the ladder of talent. Many of those people are actually quite easy to deal with and sort of consummate professionals and really know their stuff. Mm-hmm. But as a director, your job is to take lots of disparate elements and take the talent and whatever the singers sort of bring to the table on the first day and work it into your concept so that we all wind up doing the same production by opening night. Hmm.
John, you hope that this kind of thing will continue and that it will become an established feature and not just draw all of the folks in Watseka, but bring people from all over the Midwest. And in fact, you talked mm-hmm. about the fact that people have come, even from outside of the United States, have come to see the production. What mm-hmm. what would you like to see this become?
Well, I have several goals with the festival. And I would like to say that more than the opera. You know, we have a whole weekend of activities we're doing as a festival. You know, we have a Saturday evening symphony we're doing with work by Beethoven and Mendelssohn and Aaron Copland. And we're holding an art fair on Saturday, a taste of Sugar Creek on Saturday as well. There's an open house at a historic home. And so there's just a lot of things going on, you know, for the whole weekend. And that's what we want to see happen. And we want to grow this into something that is a festival that becomes a destination for people. And to do that, we need to grow our audience base. We need to get the word out. And we need to raise more money and learn how to reach out into more communities for it.
Well, and I'm sorry to say we've talked all this time and we haven't given the number for people to call if they're interested in getting tickets. Someone called and said, hey, where do I call? So let's make sure that people know.
Well, I would suggest that people go onto our website at www.sugarcreekfestival.org. That's www.sugarcreekfestival.org. And they can purchase tickets through the website for all the musical events. We're also having dinners that we're doing, catered dinners, if people would like to come to those dinners, so they can make it like, excuse me, They can make it like, you know, an evening out in Chicago or in New York where they can go to dinner and then go to the theater, and they can purchase all those tickets through the festival website, and that's what I discussed.
Okay, as possible as it is to believe, not everyone has internet access. So, is it possible just to call and reserve some tickets?
Yes, the number is 866-468-3401. That's the ticketing service. It's TicketWeb. And they tell them you're calling for Sugar Creek Symphony and Song, and they'll get you lined up.
Okay. So 866-468-3401.
Yes.
Right. Okay. And otherwise, there is a website that has information about the festival, a lot of things that are going on. And if people want to go that way, they can certainly get their tickets through the website. That might indeed, as you say, probably be the easiest way to do it. Well, we're at the point here we're going to have to stop. I want to thank you all very much. Our guest again this morning, John Whitman. He is president and executive director of the Sugar Creek Symphony and Song in Watseka. The performance is this weekend. And also here with us, Christine McIntyre. She's the stage director. And Sean Sims. He is one of the cast members. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Our program, Focus 580, is made possible in part by Strawberry Fields on West Springfield Avenue in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields provides a wide assortment of natural foods, vitamins, bulk herbs, fresh breads, and produce. The Strawberry Fields Cafe, looking out on Springfield Avenue, features expanded seating for the deli and the coffee bar. Today's program also made possible by grants from 10,000 Villages in downtown Champaign and Crossroads Global Handcrafts, 428 North Main in Bloomington, providing income to third world artisans by marketing their handicrafts and telling their stories in North America. The WYLO Sweepstakes is here. Enter today. You could win the $2,000 grand prize shopping spree plus design services from Carter's Furniture, or the $2,000 garden grand prize from Country Arbors, or one of 11 other prizes, including a Dell computer, a handcrafted Shaker dining table, a home theater audio system, and more. Watch your mail for the sweepstakes packet and enter soon. And if you would like to request an entry form, you can call us at 217-333-1070. That's it for us here on Focus 580, but we want you to stay tuned. Coming up next is the Afternoon Magazine. The host for the show, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we'll talk about reducing crime and building community support for policing. Our guest will be David Harris. He's a professor of law and values at the University of Toledo. He's an authority on racial profiling, and he is the author of a new book on preventive policing. The title? Good Cops. He'll join us at 1:06. Let's take a look now at what's happening on the Chicago Board of Trade. September wheat trading at 324.5, down 1.5. December 339, down 2.5. September corn 225.25, down 1.75. December 238.25, down 1.75. March corn 246.25, down 1.5. And May corn trading at 252.5, down 0.5. August soybeans 669.5, down